Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beets. Beets are a nutritional gold mine, full of antioxidants and nutrients, but they're a mess to prepare. So just mix Super Beets with 4 ounces of water and boost circulation, relax arteries, and maintain healthy blood pressure. Get the Dr. Hoffman special offer at intelligentbeets.com. That's intelligentbeets.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about women's health. And this is actually a subject that we've touched upon recently. We talked about women's sexual health with Dr. Madeline Castellano, and we also talked last week with Dr. Joel Evans, who is an obstetrician gynecologist practicing integrative medicine. And today we're going to talk to another OBGYN who's doing pioneering work, but I think brings a slightly different perspective to the problem of dealing with women's health. She is Dr. Eden Fromberg. She practices here in New York at SoHo OBGYN, which is one of the most innovative holistic women's care facilities in the country, if not the world. And she also, interestingly, is founder and director of Lila Yoga, Dharma, and Wellness. So she incorporates yoga and movement therapy in her work. And specifically, she takes a special interest in the complex areas of female pain, pelvic floor, and sexual dysfunction using an integrative perspective. She is also author of a book, which actually she's not author of a book. She has appeared prominently in the film The Business of Being Born. So she has an interest in natural childbirth. And so without further ado, here's our guest, Dr. Eden Fromberg. Dr. Fromberg, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's my pleasure entirely. So tell us a little bit about your journey and how you went into a highly innovative branch of OBGYN. You know, the training to become an obstetrician gynecologist is very rigorous. They want you to toe the line. They believe in, you know, all the suitable precautions, hospital birth, heavy-duty monitoring. So how did you kind of break out of that mold a little bit?
Well, I think I broke out of that mold on the day that I was born, to be perfectly honest, because in 1965, my mother planned to have a natural childbirth against all odds. I think, you know, it wasn't even really that much known about in 1965 that you could do this. So she went to a natural childbirth class, she prepared, and she was there with her glasses and her watch breathing and being made fun of by a bunch of nurses, and the doctor was nowhere to be found when I came out. They weren't used to it.
So you're a second-generation holistic person then?
Oh, third generation.
No, oh, there you go.
Just to diverge. No, my grandparents were all vegetarian, and one set of grandparents owned a Hygiology, a vegetarian hotel and retreat that's near where Omega Institute is today, mm-hmm. and that's actually where my parents met. So my parents met, and I think the vegetarianism was part of what attracted them to each other. But anyhow, so yeah, I had a very holistic sort of background in that regard. So when my mother had a baby, of course she planned natural childbirth. It just wasn't something that had much of a context yet in 1965, so she was kind of a pioneer in her own right. And so, yeah, so there was no doctor there. I just kind of popped out on a stretcher with nurses screaming everywhere is the way the story goes. And so growing up, I was, you know, I grew up vegetarian, naturopathic diet, breastfeeding, and a holistic perspective. And so when it came time for me as a young woman to visit the gynecologist, it was pretty clear to me that what was going on was very much at odds with what I was reading in various feminist women's health books that were out at the time. Like, my mother got Ms. Magazine. I was reading books with names like Vaginal Politics, for example, or Spiritual Midwifery, or Hygieia, a Woman's Herbal. So I was learning from books I was reading that there was a whole world of midwifery and herbal medicine and you know, women's empowerment. But when I was going to the doctor myself, that was not what was happening there. And I realized that there was this huge gap in care. And I decided that because I was a smart kid with an intellectual mother who pressured me in that direction, that I would go to medical school. And I did that, and it was a very difficult journey, of course, a lot of academic training, a lot of rigorous training with obstetrical night call and surgeries and all kinds of things going on. But
and frankly, from my experience in medical school, a lot of pressure and brainwashing as well to conform.
Well, yeah, but I went into it kind of with the perspective of that I was there to learn, and that I had my own thought process that I could bring any information to and critically inquire about it. I mean, my mother's actually an academic. She's an early childhood educator. So, you know, being intellectualized at a young age had its good and bad points, but ultimately it made me very critical inquiry is a big part of what I do, and I believe in research and innovation. You know, I'm not just going to do what's going on clinically now. I'm going to look at the research and innovation and not wait 15 or 20 years for information. I'll just give you one example.
Sure.
Cord cutting. You know, most of the time babies come out, the cord is cut immediately, but in recent years, there's actually now medical literature that supports the idea of delaying.
That's something that came out just recently about that, about delaying
right.
the cord cutting, yeah.
Right, and so for many years, I was delaying cord cutting more from an intuitive perspective. It just seemed gentler and a nicer thing to do, and it also kept the mother and baby closer to each other, especially environments when the baby ears are often whisked away for resuscitation that they may or may not actually need. And so doing something that was intuitively a gentler practice, now there's medical literature to support it. That doesn't mean the practice changes overnight, but certainly neonatal anemia and diminished brain development are two potential consequences. And then there are also connective tissue and emotional consequences to early cord cutting that we're now understanding.
Right. It's important to cut the cord, either you know, physically or metaphysically at some point, but we don't want to do it too precipitously. Yeah, ultimately, yeah, in natural childbirth.
You don't have to cut the cord. There
right.
is actually a modality called lotus birth in which parents intentionally
exactly.
choose not to cut the cord.
Yes.
So, yeah, but fortunately, the cord falls off on its own.
It atrophies, right. So, you know, you're still in the process of birthing babies, right?
Occasionally. I would say that my obstetrical career is more counseling and talking
okay.
to people and doing international work. I go to Bali and I work with Robin Lim and the Yayasan Bumi Sahat project over there. And in America, occasionally, like, for example, I have a friend who's giving birth at home in February, and she does have a midwife, but I'll certainly be present and available to my friend.
Well, you know, more and more in America, there's a problem because a lot of OBGYNs are eschewing the GYN part. I'm sorry, the OB part, and they're just becoming GYNs. They don't want any part of the complex, high-risk, high-liability, you know, painstaking process of giving birth, and they're getting out of that. So there's actually a shortage of – there's a lot of women's care specialists, but many of them just are GYNs. They'll do your pelvic exam. They'll operate on your fibroids, but they won't go into the delivery room with you.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you could say that I'm one of them because I'm really not going into the delivery room so much anymore, but there's a good reason for that. I mean, kind of a multiple reason, but one reason is that now that I'm in an independent practice, the malpractice insurance premiums are extremely high.
And that's a big part of it. What's that like
yeah.
for doctors? I mean, it's so daunting that a lot of doctors say, I don't want to go there.
Yeah, so that's very hard, but also there is a high risk of potentially being sued, which is of concern
sure.
for doctors. I think that for me, it was a combination of that, but also I was making a change in my career, and I wanted to speak more freely about these issues because they are so important. And so in an era when vaginal birth after cesarean was almost the norm and many women were having that, that was when I was trained. But the more recent 20 years, it's really changed a lot, and there's been a very high intervention, sort of a turn that obstetrics has taken. And I don't know, I guess I felt like many of my patients would benefit much greater from me speaking about these mm-hmm. issues honestly and referring them to the appropriate people, which are often home birth and hospital birthing midwives, as opposed to doctors in some cases. So I got out of doing the hands-on labor and delivery obstetrics for those reasons, and I really do feel strongly that being in a position to speak about it is very, very important, because I think that I went into the field of obstetrics hoping that I could change the landscape of it. And it's actually kind of surprising to me the way that things have become so interventive. I would like to speak a little bit about midwifery, though, and the idea that doctors supporting midwives could actually, in a collaborative care model, present the safest option and would also fill the gap that we see in obstetrical providers who are really offering women the types of birth experiences that they want and are asking for.
What is the status of midwifery these days? Because it's actually making a comeback, and even in advanced, it's not just in remote country areas where there's a shortage of doctors, but also in urban enclaves like Soho in Manhattan.
Yeah, I think that there is actually a need for midwifery, but that we don't have a system that's very welcoming of it from both the health insurance perspective. It's just sort of not set up to understand what it is that midwives are sometimes doing, and so they have to apply to get reimbursement outside of the health insurance system. And then on the other hand, it's that state laws are very variable, and doctors' personal willingness is very variable in terms of backing up midwives and having good collaborative options for them. And so there's a lot of women who would like to have midwifery care, and I think that there are issues of, people express issues of potential safety, but I think that if you really look at worldwide research and think about it, what you'll see is that when midwives are working in collaboration with good backup relationships with doctors and hospitals, and there is a more seamless care model, it is quite safe. And when you have a care model, as is often found in the U.S., where the midwives feel like there is no doctor with whom they have a personal or friendly relationship or official backup relationship, they just have to bring patients to the ER and leave them and see what happens, it doesn't feel good to anybody involved.
Right.
So I really feel that these care models can change and hopefully are changing for the better.
Is it a matter of political will? Because it's a lot of the liability laws, the way that we have things set up, I think it discourages doctors from consorting with midwives and midwives from practicing, because just the enormous, there's probably nothing that is more fraught with peril, usually a benign process, but potentially fraught with peril and liability than a birth.
Yeah, it's absolutely a big issue in obstetrics in America. The whole liability issue is huge. There really does need to be more tort reform, as we call it, where they change the laws about this. Because it's true, I've had a bad case, and it really does sort of alter your feelings about things, because you feel like, maybe I'll just play it safe. Maybe it's just easier to do C-section on everybody. And in fact, I'm quoted in The Business of Being Born, one of the instructors in my residency, he said, if in doubt, just do a C-section.
Yep.
They won't fault you if you just do a C-section.
Exactly.
And it's terrible that women have to be served by a system in which people are so afraid of childbirth that they have to just do surgery on them to avoid any of these liability issues.
So what's wrong with the C-section, other than that it's an unnatural birth process? I'm sure you can wax eloquent on how it differs from a natural passage to the birth canal.
Sure. One thing I want to make clear is that no woman should feel judged or guilty that she's had a cesarean section. Often I find that women express this to me, and, we're in a system where vaginal birth isn't valued quite as much as it should, and perhaps the negative aspects of C-section are also not fully appreciated. So I want every woman to know that this is not a value or judgment on you or the choices that you or your doctors may have made, but hopefully this information can serve people in the future of making the best decisions. So first of all, a C-section is obviously surgery. Surgery has a risk to the woman and to the baby. It's putting a scar into the woman's body, and it can have damaging effects to the bladder, the connective tissue. It can cause scarring. It can cause chronic pain, and it can cause damage to the organs and tissues. It can also cause a problem called placenta accreta in future pregnancies, in which the placenta can grow into the uterine scar and sometimes even beyond it into the bladder or even the wall of the abdomen, and it can become a very dangerous situation to try to deliver the baby and then the placenta in a subsequent pregnancy when the placenta is attached to everything else. It's very hard to separate that and can cause hemorrhage and even death. So there are definitely, there's a higher mortality and morbidity, as we call it, rate with cesarean section. But there are other issues for the baby. For example, the baby usually spirals down the birth canal, and it's considered that there's some benefit to that process in priming the baby neurologically, but also the passage through the birth canal primes the baby's immune system via the microbiome of the mother's vagina. So there are a lot of flora and microbes in there, and these are the good guys. Like, you know, we talk about probiotics, so people have some idea, hopefully, what I'm talking about. But all the bacteria in the vagina, they're good for the baby. They are going to talk to the baby's immune system on a microscopic level and let the baby's immune system start to develop a relationship with the outside world. And what we're finding is that the babies born vaginally develop that relationship quite well and have lower incidences of autoimmune disease, from asthma to rheumatoid arthritis, all kinds of issues, gastrointestinal issues, than the babies born by cesarean. And so the microbiome is a big deal. And it can be gotten around some. Like, there's a study right now being done in which gauze is put into the woman's vagina, and before she receives antibiotics or before she is cut for the cesarean, the gauze is removed and put in a sterile cup. And after the baby's born, they then take the gauze and they put it on the baby's mouth, in the eyes, on the skin, and they
it's like an inoculation.
Yeah, so they're seeding the baby's microbiome with the mother's vaginal flora that
that's
it wasn't exposed to otherwise. Yeah, so there are ways to get around it. And I suppose there, I should speak about that cesarean sections can be done in a way that is more humane from a few perspectives. One is that neonatal resuscitation can be done without cutting the cord immediately, even in the instance of a cesarean section in many cases, and there are many doctors who are starting to do this more in conjunction with willing pediatric teams. So, and they're finding that not cutting the cord actually gives the baby automatic resuscitation without, you know, cutting it and then going to resuscitate. There's actually oxygen and nutrients coming in. The drape can be brought down so that the woman can see her baby, possibly touch her baby, depending on the circumstance. So there are a lot of ways that cesarean section can be made more humane and be made more beneficial to the baby when it is truly necessary. But the fact that it's overused and that it's used as a stopgap for liability concerns and not necessarily as the best thing for mother and baby is what the problem is.
Yeah. Are we over-infatuated with our high-tech monitoring capabilities? Because, you know, we monitor, you know, we do the ultrasounds, we do the, you know, the fetal distress monitoring. Does that, I mean, certainly in some instances, of course, that can save lives of mother and baby, but perhaps that leads us to too many false alarms.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of downside to electronic fetal monitoring. And what I'm talking about is essentially, you know, the belt or the band that's strapped around a woman's belly when she's in labor, and it has transducers that pick up on fetal heart tones and contractions, and they usually graph it out on electronic or on paper. The problem is that women...
A midwife can't do that, so that's, I mean, a midwife is in a sense of...
Midwives can work with electronic fetal monitoring, and many do in hospital settings.
Okay.
But the thing with it is that it's actually not an evidence-based kind of a technique. There is no evidence that shows that this technique improves fetal outcomes. In fact, it actually may have a downside because, one, women have to be fairly immobile because movement might alter the way that these lines are being interpreted on the graph, and so movement can alter that. The other thing is that if she's lying around, she's not able to fully participate physically in the birth process. Plus, there's this focus. I mean, literally, there's a focus on the fetal monitor that is abnormal. Like, if I would walk into a room and say to a woman, oh, are you feeling any contractions? She would just turn her head and look at the monitor. And I said, are you feeling contractions?
Yes,
like,
right.
What do you feel? I don't care what that machine says. I want to know what you're feeling. And, yeah, so there's this deference to the machine, like the machine knows better. And, you know, even the providers, I think, get a little lazy with that. But the problem is, especially in a busy hospital, think about it. You have all these graphs coming up on a nursing station in an electronic array. People are not paying attention to this woman. What she really needs is somebody to hold her hand and be calming and be a force of calm and support so that she can feel comfortable having her baby. There's this idea that there's a machine, but I almost think of those poor little rhesus monkeys in the Harry Harlow studies who were deprived of true mothers. It's like they were given wire mothers and they became really kind of freaked out. People want human contact, so having this electronic experience, it detaches women from their bodies, it detaches her care providers from caring for her, and it creates a lot of false alarms in terms of these dips that people will see, which often can just be the head being compressed or something that's not a big deal. But, you know, if there's any doubt, again, just do a C-section. So there's this fetal monitor strip that we know as doctors will be brought into that court of law, and every little blip that isn't perfect will be teased apart by a lawyer. So knowing that, it does make it very difficult to stand up to the fetal monitor when you know it's fine, but you know, oh, somebody could really interpret this wrong in a court of law.
During my OBGYN rotation, I was not obviously trained extensively, but every doctor goes through an OBGYN rotation. Women almost unanimously got an episiotomy, which looked to me as a med student quite brutal. It was a slice across the muscular ring that expanded to allow the baby's head to pass through in order to facilitate the birth passage. And I just read that now they're, I mean, probably you have a lot more background on this, but now they're saying that this is going to be virtually outlawed because it just caused a lot of damage and it's unnecessary.
Well, I don't know. I hadn't heard that episiotomies were going to be outlawed, but and I can't imagine
disfavored
that.
Maybe is a better word.
Yeah. Well, the issue with episiotomies is that it's making the cut true in the perineum, in the muscular ring that surrounds the vagina, and you know whether it's necessary or not is something that I decided to experiment with when I was working in an inner city hospital in Philadelphia during my residency, and we were delivering like 25 babies a night. I mean, it was out of control how many babies.
So I just thought,
all right, I won't do episiotomies on some of these people. I'll see what happens. And what I discovered was that, yes, a woman having her very first baby can have a 9-pound, 4-ounce baby with no episiotomy and not tear at all. I learned these types of things. So I guess what I'm saying is that when a woman's giving birth, I see no problem in waiting to see whether or not an episiotomy may or may not be necessary, because most of the time I find that it is not. And when one is cut, it's sort of like when you make a slit in a sheet. There's actually studies that show if you cut an episiotomy, it's more likely to tear to a higher degree, tear into the rectal sphincter or all the way into the rectum.
What problems can arise later in life after that?
Yeah, there's all kinds of scarring and pelvic floor dysfunction. And so one of the things that I have specialized in is helping women who have not healed well or have not been repaired well after a vaginal birth. And I have one patient I'm thinking of now. And, you know, it's not atypical. What will happen is it'll be like an open area. There might be some tissue that's very inflamed and sensitive emerging from that area. And there may even be issues with the rectal sphincter or ability to control stool or gas emission and things like that. There can be sexual pain. There can be issues with urination if it's more on the anterior side. So it is a really big deal. Now, this is not an argument against vaginal birth, as scary as all of this stuff may sound. This is rare stuff that comes up just in a few women, but it is serious stuff, and it really is the reason why I do teach suturing for doctors and midwives, and I do really strongly feel that suturing properly after childbirth is extremely important, and understanding some of the principles of healing.
Right, to avoid the problems that you encounter later in your clinical practice.
Right. I mean, you know, it's not that we can't treat scars and do physical therapy and do all these things, but it's better if things are more intact from the get-go than having to try to revise it later.
Okay. This is a logical point at which to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. So let's stipulate this is part one of our discussion with Dr. Eden Fromberg about women's health issues, in particular pregnancy, birth. And in part two, we're going to focus on women's pain issues, vulvodynia and pain on intercourse, which is a specialty of today's guest, Dr. Fromberg, and also talk a little bit about how you incorporate yoga and movement therapies into your practice, because you sort of have a dual focus professionally. One is as an MD, and the other is as a practitioner and instructor of yoga and movement therapies. So that'll give you a preview to part two. We hope you'll join us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.